ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making its one nation.
This is the unlikely story of one nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The Making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
This is The Book Show. Hello, I'm Claire Nichols. The Book Show is where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. Later, you'll meet the Melbourne writer John Morrissey. But first, it's WA's Holden Shepherd, the creator of Invisible Boys. Invisible Boys. You might have read the 2019 novel or seen the recent TV adaptation. It's about three teenage boys, Charlie, Zeke and Cade, better known as Hammer, all growing up gay and closeted in the regional town of Geraldton, where Holden Shepherd himself grew up. Now, I first met Holden in early 2020, not long after that first book was published. And since then, the book has become a bestseller, there's the TV adaptation, and now a sequel, Yeah, the Boys. And actually, a TV deal has just been announced for this new book too. Holden and I got together in front of a live audience in Perth on Whadjuk Noongar land for a very fun and moving conversation, and there was a bit of colourful language too. So please consider this your warning. Holden started by telling me about his childhood in Geraldton.
Yeah, so Gero, which is what we all call Geraldton. If you are from there, you're a Gero Dero. Geraldton is a regional city where the outback meets the ocean. So it's, 4 hours from anything in any direction. Very coastal kind of place, surfy, lots of, mining trucks and trains coming through the town to the port. Really nice place to grow up. I had a great time growing up there. Lots of time, we had like a half an acre, so we had, dogs and cats, and spent a lot of time on the trampoline staring up at the sky and dreaming about books when I was an angsty teenager. Really nice place to grow up, obviously, also with its own challenges as a more regional place with no gay scene for me specifically, but I love Gero a lot.
What's more unusual in Geraldton, wanting to be a writer or being gay?
They're right up there together, I think. And then I kind of went and did both, which is, not the most common journey for any Gero boy. We do have like a famous writer from Geraldton, Randolph Stowe, if people have known of Randolph Stowe. So the local young adult writer's prize for teenagers is called the Randolph Stowe Award. I got second place when I was 17. No, I'm not happy about it. I'm pissed. I wanted first, and first prize went to the girl I took to the ball. So a little bit awkward there.
Well, you guys were like the literary, duo.
Literary
around town.
Power couple, yeah.
Were you out when you were there?
No. It's funny because of what I write now, people kind of know a little bit of that I grew up gay in Geraldton and all of that. And occasionally people will be like, wow, that's really brave that you, came out in Geraldton. I'm like, I did not do that. I can read the room. I can read, the space I'm in. I'm from a big Italian family. Dad was one of 11 kids. I'm one of six kids. I'm one of the little kids. I'm number five of six. And we're all kind of in, Dad was an earth moving. That's what he did for 40 years. My uncles were brickies. Me and my brothers worked on the mini excavators with Dad and as labourers. So you're digging trenches with a whole bunch of guys who, no one's pro-gay. There definitely are people around who are like that, but it definitely wasn't that kind of environment. So, and probably the sense I had is also talked about in Yeah, the Boys is that if I come out, I'm going to be seen as someone really different to who I am. And that's probably Matt's journey in Invisible Boys that he unfortunately really doesn't succeed in grappling with. Mm. But I felt like Matt. I was like, if I come out, you're all going to see me as something I'm not, and I have to choose one or the other. Mm. And it was just too hard. So it wasn't just pure kind of homophobia is bad. Of course it is. But even when you're in the closet, you kind of keep yourself there because you're like, I'm just going to be so badly misread if I come out.
That's so interesting when you say I'm going to be seen as something I'm not. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, I think there were just such kind of persistent reified kind of stereotypes about what a gay dude is, and like no shade on the gay dudes who are like that, because you know I now live in Perth, so I'm on the gay scene, and there's lots of dudes who absolutely love, you know, Kylie and all of that kind of stuff. My husband happens to be one of them. In fact, he's a big fan of Kylie Minogue, which is, I think, like the universe ironically punishing me, because I was like, I like rock and roll and I like punk and I like metal, so you know that's what I am about. And I married a guy who loves Kylie and Delta Goodrum and Cher, and I have seen them all live now. I've met Delta Goodrum like 3 times now. He's that kind of fan. So, but there was this perception generally that it reifies kind of gayness as effeminacy. And I really struggled with that. And, you know, I'm a writer. That's a sensitive kind of thing. But in terms of my interests, it didn't kind of match up. Mm. So I really struggled with the idea that I'll be really misunderstood if I come out. And I just didn't want to.
Mm. You published Invisible Boys in 2019. It's about 3 16-year-olds. There's Zeke, there's Charlie and Hammer. Mm. They're all gay. At the start of the book, none of them are out. They're in Geraldton. You've told me before that each of the characters in this book is a part of you. So there's the head, the heart and the body, which I love. So let's start with the body.
Yep.
At 16, who is Hammer?
So Hammer is Hammer is the bully. He's the jock. He is incredibly arrogant, incredibly full of himself, but very much hiding this sense of, you know, he's bullying the gay kid or Charlie or Zeke. He's bullying the lesser, weaker boys as he sees them. And obviously it's masking that, you know, he's so afraid of dealing with his own stuff. So he's also grappling with it in Invisible Boys. But that's where he is when he's 16.
Mm. What about Zeke? Who is Zeke?
So Zeke is the head, the mind of the book. He is the thinker. He thinks deeply about everything. He's really trying to grapple with this sense of, I've been raised Catholic, I know I'm gay, and on some level I'm fine with it. I know it's not a religious issue. So he's trying to kind of philosophically think about, how do I mesh who I am with my family, with my school, with my religion.
Mm. And then we have Charlie.
Yeah, Charlie's the upstart, or as they referred to him in the writer's room for Invisible Boys when we made the TV show, a little shit. but Charlie's the punk, and he's, you know, always angry, and he's an angry ant, and you know, I can't tell you where that comes from, but he is kind of already out and already exploring who he is, and just a really fiery adolescent, angsty, angry young man. And I really enjoyed writing him because he was anger, you know, like he's allowed to express his anger, and he comes across a bit horrible sometimes.
Is that a good exercise to get some of that anger out on the page?
Oh yeah, I haven't got it all out yet. I've written 4 books and it's still coming. But definitely Charlie was a huge release valve for me. Mm. It doesn't seem realistic because of probably my brand and what I'm known for, and it is all very gay and it's all very, you know, blokey and working class gays and all of that. But until I wrote Invisible Boys, I never talked about this. I never talked about my sexuality. I didn't like it. Mm. I was openly gay, and then it was like, let's not talk about that and let's move on. So writing Charlie, writing Zeke and writing Hammer, I felt like I wrote myself into existence when I wrote that book in 2017, and it changed my life in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it changed your life. I mean, it's a beautiful book. I highly recommend reading it for anyone who hasn't. But it also changed your life in that it was this huge success. And I think when we met, you know, 6 years ago, we didn't know what Invisible Boys was going to become. Like, what has it meant to have this level of success with that novel?
Yeah, it's unexpected. I'm fortunate enough to be looking at some of my publishing team here at Fremantle Press who published Invisible Boys, and I'm always very grateful that they took a chance on this book, because we didn't know necessarily that it would be what it became. It was this edgy gay book that didn't fit anywhere. You know, it was too adult for young adult. It was too, you know, it was too something for everyone. And I didn't think I had a particularly interesting life. Before Invisible Boys, I was writing fantasy, and so I didn't think I had much to say. And when I did write this and I found a publisher who did want to give it a run, give it a go, we were completely blown away by the reaction. I think the first week, it went into reprint in the first week of sales because it was just out the gate. Everyone was hungry for a book that talked about this in Australia, maybe in an honest way. And then it just kept going. It was not, it wasn't this massive immediate bestseller. It was, you know, I think we had that chat at my house a few months in maybe.
Yeah.
And it was doing good. It had started well, but it just kept going and kept going and kept going. And it became an Australian bestseller based on having a long tail is what they call it in the publishing world. It just kept selling and kept selling and, you know, then started to start selling more. Absolutely wild. And then obviously became a TV show. So I never expected to be talking about any of these themes in my life in front of people. You know, it's not something I planned on. I'm really glad I did it. It's been rewarding for me. It's been cathartic for me, but it's also been incredibly rewarding and validating to have a lot of people reach out over the last 6-7 years who have grown up gay in some tiny town somewhere, anywhere in Australia, and they went through the same thing, and it doesn't matter which decade. It can be now, it can be 10 years ago, it can be 50 years ago. I've got guys who are in their 70s and 80s saying how much it feels exactly the same as when they grew up in their town. So that's been a really rewarding element of the book.
Being the guy who never planned to talk about any of this stuff and writing this book, not knowing who it's for, then suddenly everybody's read this book and you've been so upfront of saying these are all parts of me. What does it mean for you when people in your life read a book like Invisible Boys? What do they come back to you to say?
We try not to talk about it. my family, especially when I put a book out, they'll kind of be like, yep, read it. And because they're so graphic and they're so sexual and they're so honest. And there's drugs and there's mental health and all of that. So, most of the time it'll be some version of, yep, good book, well written. When the TV show came out, that was wild because Zeke's there and the TV show had like bodily fluids flying through the air, you know, like it was graphic, and I'm watching it with my family, you know, so it was kind of like, you know, when you're a teenager and you're watching a movie with your family and a sex scene comes on, like that, but times a million, and you're all just like, just keep looking forward, no one make eye contact, let's never talk about this ever again. So that's the reaction, but in general terms, positive. You know, like, you know, my parents were there at the launch of the book, and King of Dirt was dedicated to my dad, so like he came to that launch and that kind of thing. My siblings have been really cool with it, so mostly everyone's mature.
Yeah. The TV adaptation, how involved in that were you?
I was lucky enough to be very involved. I was included in the writer's room from the beginning, so I was part of that development process where for about six of the 10, I was in that room where we kind of do break everything apart and what was referred to as kicking the tires, and they really kicked the tires. You know, it is confronting when, you know, you're hearing someone kind of describe the characters as whatever they are, or Zeke's being a little bit weak here, or Charlie's being such a little whatever, and you're like, this is me. You're saying I have no spine. You're saying you're saying I'm being a little whatever. So that was really great to be in the room, but wow, it was hard to see that kind of torn apart in front of you when it's your own life, when it's your own coming out experience. But very grateful to have been in that room and to have been included. And I wrote two of the episodes, so the screenplay for episode 4 and episode 8, which are the kind of Italian woggy episodes because I have that Italian background. Those were me, and that was really rewarding. Episode 4 was the one I kind of showed my dad and was like, you have to watch the sauce making scene, because it was literally like our whole lives in the summer was growing up making sauce. It was the best time of the whole year. Me and my cousins and uncles and aunties, like everyone got together. And then probably my favourite childhood memories, to be honest, the whole time from when I was born until into my adulthood. And so many of them have actually passed recently. So it's that kind of thing of knowing it's not going to happen again. So it felt really special, and I really wanted to make sure I wrote it onto the show. So it's like immortalised forever that we used to do this. We used to play cricket afterwards, and yes, you know, people, you know, maybe one of the mums, one of the matriarchs and one of the sister-in-laws would be having a little bit of a, I'm going to splash you and get you back with squirt tomato juice at you. it was a special time. So I'm glad I got to do that.
That's really, really cool. So you've had this incredible success with Invisible Boys. You've had the TV adaptation do so well. And then we've got this, Yeah, the Boys, which is officially a sequel, but this is actually the first story you came up with. Can you explain the timeline here?
Yes. Yeah, it's really odd, but I'm so excited to have this book out more than any other book I've ever done. I had the idea when I was at university. I did an honours thesis, and it was about, this is going to sound like wanky, but it was like the nexus of masculinity and male homosexuality. And it was all about this character who was, you know, the gay footy player and a labourer, and he also happened to be gay. And that was me trying to kind of maybe put myself on the page in a way that I hadn't seen and not problematise it, not invisibilise it, not delegitimise it, just put the guy on the page and not say he needs to be saved from this kind of blokey world, but just say he wants to be part of it. So I had this very clear idea that I want to write this literary gay fiction thing. And I had a detour. I wrote some fantasy for a little while, thinking I could become Matthew Riley. I did not. No one wanted the fantasy book. And then I went back to this idea of, it was called Dead Straight at the time, this book. And I thought, I'm going to write Dead Straight again. So I started writing Dead Straight.
And this is essentially about a character like Hammer.
It was yeah. Cade. Yeah, it was Hammer's character. And I wanted to tell this story of this gay footy player. And it was in 2017, I sat down to start writing it, and it just didn't make sense to me that I was starting at this character at the age of 23, 24, because he would have had a clue, right? Like, he would have gone through adolescence and puberty, he would have known something about his sexuality earlier on. So I couldn't understand him. So to do a quick little exercise, I thought I'll just write a short story about Cade when he's 16. And that short story went for 100,000 words. And it's called Invisible Boys. So it was a really happy mistake, but it was, and not a mistake, it was part of the process. But ever since, I had it in mind that I really wanted to get back to actually telling the story I wanted to tell. I had the gay AFL, you know, at elite level. I wanted to tell that story about that guy. So I finally got there. I had a few detours along the way with other books, but this is the book I've kind of been anxious to tell.
Mm. Yeah. We're going to come to Cade or Hammer, the jock, the footy player, in a moment. But I do want to just check in with our other two boys who are not so invisible in the sequel. So Charlie, was the one who was the naughty one, the punk, the musician, the angry boy. Mm. Where is he at as a 24-year-old?
He has failed in his music career. So Charlie's idea was that, you know, I'm going to get famous and I'm going to leave Juro in a blaze of glory and I'll be a big famous rock star. And would you believe, you know, in 2025 in Perth, you don't get rich and famous as a punk rocker. You know, definitely not with an EP called Cocksucker. You know, like, that doesn't work. So Charlie's failed. He's tried to be a punk. It didn't work. His blaze of glory didn't pan out. He's now working in a bar, which he hopes might be a new reason to live. He's got a couple of mentors called Curtis and Ahmed, who are an older gay couple who've kind of taken him in, and they're starting up a gay male-only bar, which becomes a little bit controversial in its own right, but it's a space to kind of reclaim just for gay men to be ourselves in that space. So Charlie's working for them and hoping that leads to some meaning. He's also processing what happened in Invisible Boys, which was big, and it's a lot of grief, and there's a lot of stuff for him to work through that he hasn't yet faced. So that's where we find Charlie at the start of Year of the Boys.
And Zeke, who was our nerdy guy making sauce with the family, you know, going to Catholic school, getting good marks. What's going on with Zeke in Year of the Boys?
Was he the one who most surprised you from the first book to the second book?
I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of this from people because they're like, he was so sweet and so soft. And as I was at I was in Brisbane two nights ago, and the interviewer said, "So what's happened to Zeke?" He's like, "He was so nice, and now he's in his raging slut era." And I think that's a really good call. Like, that is where we find Zeke, because he was, you know, he had to be nice, he had to be a good boy to survive Catholic high school and a small town, and try to be a good boy and try to be respectable. And now he's free. He's got the anonymity of a big city. And so he is running around and enjoying himself, and as he bloody well should. Like, he's had a hard life and he wants to enjoy himself, but it has led to him being really lonely. Yeah. He's pursued kind of hedonism and being able to be himself, but it's come at the cost of connection. And he's not romantically linked with anyone. He doesn't really have mates. He doesn't really do anything he's passionate about. He's working at a call center. He's graduating from uni from a degree that he doesn't care about. Doesn't even matter. Like, why did he study English in an era when AI does everything? You know, he's like, what's the point? Why did I do this? So Zeke is Zeke's journey is about finding this gay footy team that unexpectedly is the opposite of what he thought he would have wanted. He's not a jock. But when he knows he's not going to get bullied by a hammer type, he's kind of like, that actually could be really fun and maybe I'd actually make some friends.
So he's joining a really amateur footy group, but...
Proudly mediocre.
Yeah.
Is but, their tagline.
But Hammer, you know, and he, the most closeted character from the first book, he's made it. He's made it all the way to the AFL.
Got everything he ever wanted. Yeah.
Kind of. Playing for the Eagles. Tell me about his life.
Yes. So Hammer is a successful star, full forward, playing for the West Coast Eagles. And he's got everything. He's got the penthouse. He's got a lot of money, a huge amount of fame and success. But he still has not dealt with who he is, obviously. He can usually get by just fine until where we meet him and, the boys in his first chapter. The Eagles decide we're going to do a pride round. And suddenly Hammer's forced to confront, does he want to wear a rainbow Guernsey? Does he want to be having all this on his own body when he is so against it and he's so unable to deal with who he is? So he thinks it would be a very good idea to mouth off publicly that he hates pride, which goes down about as well as you would expect in 2025 in the AFL as it currently stands. Funnily enough, this was all written before any AFL players came out. Also, we've had a bisexual player and a gay player come out in the last 6, 8 months, whatever it's been. And so this, I'm a prophet, I think. Like, I can't explain it any other way. Like, I nailed the exact year that they would come out and everything.
But of course, you're not a prophet because, of course...
But
what I'm saying is... There have been gay men in Aussie rules before now. Statistically, that must be true.
Yes.
But they obviously haven't felt that they have been able to be openly gay.
Mm.
What's the problem there?
Yeah, so, and yes, statistically, we know if there's however many hundreds of elite-level AFL players at any given moment, there's 18 teams, there are a lot of guys out there. There's a whole bunch who will statistically be gay or bisexual.
Yeah.
There are two things going on. One is the levels of homophobia in those spaces that just make it impossible to even question it or even say how you feel. And when I was in Adelaide last week, I actually had Lee Ryswick, who's the first gay AFL player. He came along to my event. And so we got to have a chance. We went to the pub afterwards and we chatted for like 2 hours. And it was so insightful to hear how it is in those spaces. It's, and we know that anyway, without having to be an elite AFL player, I can tell you how it would have felt anyway. So there's that level of, you know, homophobia plus public scrutiny that make it kind of prohibitive for you to want to come out even. Why would you want to bring that on yourself in a way if you could get away with not? I completely understand that. The second thing is what I just recently wrote an op-ed for the Star Observer about us as progressives, us as pro-gay or gay people, we have such a kind of thirst or an appetite for a hero. We want a role model. We want someone to come out and be the poster boy and become an activist. And I think we're putting too much pressure on these guys because they probably don't want that. They probably are. There are Hammers and there are versions of Holden Shepherd who are playing AFL and they don't want their sexuality to completely define them. I didn't. It's ridiculous because I am now a professional homosexual, right? But but I didn't want it to define me. And I've had to work hard to kind of push back against people's perceptions of me. And they would have to do that times a million because they're being watched and scrutinized all the time. And so I've argued that, you know, we need to take the pressure off them a little bit and maybe imagine that the guy who comes out might want to just say, yes, I'm gay and can we not really talk about it and can I just play some footy because I care more about a premiership flag than a rainbow flag and I think that's okay. I think we should let them do that. Not everyone wants to come out at work full stop.
You are writing about Hammer here as a star for the West Coast Eagles. How painful is that for you? Because if there's one thing you'll know about Holden Shepherd, he does not support the West Coast Eagles. You're a Collingwood man, right?
I am absolutely a Collingwood man. It's the hardest, it's the most suffering I've ever done for my art. I did a little video. So I did a video of each of the boys doing a reading. So I did a Zeke reading and a Charlie reading from the boys in the last couple of months. And the last one was a Hammer one, which I left till last because it was so painful. But I pulled on a West Coast Eagles Guernsey and read a section of his part of the story. It just made sense to me that he had to be an Eagles player that, especially growing up in Jero and growing up before the Dockers were around, because I'm a little bit old, the Dockers weren't a thing. The Eagles were like, that's the peak. That is the apex of West Australian masculinity. If you want to be a man here, you have to be an Eagles player. Not in my house, it was Collingwood, but in the state, at a state level, for someone like Hammer, he has to aspire to that and he has to get it. He has to get it and then realise this is not enough to save me from who I am. So that's why we've gone there. A few people have asked if I asked for their permission, which I did not.
Yeah, I mean, have there been any conversations with the AFL? Have you heard back anything about this book?
No. I invite them to. I'd love to hear from them. Yeah. I would really like Collingwood to take like a whole bunch of copies and let me become best mates with all the players. that would be fun.
Holden Shepherd, can you say goodbye to the characters of Charlie and Zeke and Hammer now?
Oh, wow. No one's ever asked me that. And now that you have, no. I don't have any plans to write a third book in their particular lives. I think it would be like The Godfather 3. But never say never. And I did plan for it to be, if I did write 3, the books all kind of, this is just me being a nerd, a book nerd, but the opening of Invisible Boy starts with Charlie and ends with Zeke.
Yeah.
This one starts with Zeke and ends with Hammer. And so in my head I was always like, if there's a third one, it starts with Hammer and it ends with Charlie and then it becomes like a full circle. So now that you've just asked me that and I had a very visceral reaction in my gut that no, this is not, I'm not saying goodbye to them at some point, probably maybe if I have a really good idea for it, I'd write a third one. But it would have to be later in life. It would have to be, I'd have to have something new to say that's genuinely like, it's not Invisible Boys 3, The Search for More Money. It's Invisible Boys 3, here's something really important that I have to say.
Well, we did it, guys. We just made it happen. Can you please actually give a huge round of applause to Holden Shepherd?
Thank you so much, Claire. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thanks. Thank you.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Book Show with me, Claire Nichols, where things are going to get a lot creepier now. I've just read a book called Bird Deity. It's set on a strange planet where men called scouts plunder the ruins of an ancient civilization and where a human-like species still wanders. And while this all sounds very extraterrestrial, this book, well, it has a lot to say about this planet, this country, and most importantly, the act of colonisation. Bird Deity is by John Morrissey. John is a Melbourne writer of Chalcedon descent. Hi, John.
Hi, how's it going?
Really well, thank you. And this is your first novel. What's it like when you get your novel in your hands for the first time?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's something I've obviously been looking forward to for a long time. And, you know, you put a lot of work into something and then, you know, when it actually gets realised like that, it's, you know, it's a good feeling. But obviously when you look back over it, you see things you'd like to change and things
already?
You could have done differently.
Already?
But yeah, I think it's sort of inevitable, unfortunately. But yeah, always good to be done, you know.
Are you a writer who's typically pretty hard on himself?
I think so. I mean, I think most writers are. I think it's sort of a good quality. I think you do need to sort of be pretty critical of what you do just to make sure you try and keep improving all the time. Yeah.
Well, take me back to the beginning of Bird Deity. Do you remember what sparked this novel?
Yeah, it was during the lockdowns in Melbourne. I was just going for one of my, you know, daily walks and I just remember having this sort of vague mental image of a man coming out of the forest during the rain and finding a ruined building in a clearing. And I sort of sat with the image for a bit. I was like, okay, that's sort of interesting, but, you know, there wasn't much to go with it in terms of story and so forth. I suppose over the next year and a half, I just sort of sat with the idea and gradually it took on a bit more shape and I got a better idea of the world where it was set and it sort of went from there. So it was quite a long sort of gestation process, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. And I've heard this book described as cosmic horror. I've heard it described as science fiction. Does Bird Deity fit into any sort of neat category for you?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to write a science fiction book. I grew up reading a lot of science fiction. It's still one of my favourite genres. And I really wanted to write something that sort of worked on its own terms as a science fiction novel and sort of used science fiction, you know, tropes and images, you know, in a very sort of genre-specific way. Mm-hmm. And I suppose the element of cosmic horror, I mean, that's, you know, sort of a genre I've always been interested in, you know, writers like H.P. Lovecraft and Robert Chambers and so forth. And I think it just goes very well with the genre of science fiction because you can kind of open out from a more sort of traditional genre opening into something a bit more mysterious. That was definitely something which I wanted to pursue in the book.
And it's maybe a genre we don't see enough of in contemporary Australian fiction.
I'd agree with that. I think, you know, I think particularly science fiction, there's just still so much room in the genre. I think there's still so many angles that haven't really been pursued. And I think that, you know, perhaps people sort of get fixated on some of the more standard kind of genre elements of it without thinking about maybe the different directions it can take. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I suppose that was definitely something which I wanted to explore in the novel. Yeah.
So what kind of directions were you interested in taking science fiction, John?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I wanted to do a story about colonization, but I didn't want it to be a sort of one-to-one allegory with the story of colonization in any particular place, you know, with the colonization of Australia or any other country on Earth. I suppose I wanted to kind of explore more kind of general abstract elements of colonization mm-hmm. as a process, and the kind of particularly what I really wanted to look at was the effect it has on the people who are perpetrating it and how it affects their psychology and how they interact with one another. That was definitely sort of something I wanted to examine, particularly through the main character of the novel, David.
Okay. So David is wandering in this strange place. He is coming out of the forest. Tell me about the setting for Bird Deity.
Yeah, it's sort of very rainy. There's a lot of rain throughout the novel, which was sort of a bit exhausting to write after a while because I felt like I was just kind of stuck in this very kind of rainy world myself. But I suppose it was very important for me that the landscape of the novel feel very kind of real to the reader. And that's why I spent a lot of time describing it and describing its different sort of variations. But also, you know, it's a very sort of monotone landscape in the sense that there's constant rain and, you know, there's no real kind of... The settlement which David inhabits is very sort of low tech, you know, it's really just kind of a collection of small buildings and hovels and so forth. I wanted to feel very much like a kind of a very underdeveloped colony, yeah.
And he goes out into this place called the Plateau. What is the Plateau?
So it's like a area where the scouts go to collect the artifacts which they sort of plunder from the local alien species and which are sold back on Earth at high value. So I suppose, yeah, it's like ultimately the location where most of the book's action takes place. It's where he ultimately ends up, kind of meets his destiny, so to speak.
So when I look at this wet landscape, you know, this colonial outpost, and when we venture into this plateau, should I be looking for Australia when I'm reading this, John?
I mean, I think in terms of how I describe the landscape, I think obviously it's going to be based on my own experience of, you know, Australia, particularly Victoria, which is where I've lived most of my life. I suppose, yeah, again, I didn't want it to be a sort of one-to-one representation of Australia, but I did want the kind of sense of the, you know, natural rhythms of the place to feel very recognisable to Australian readers. So it was definitely obviously something which was in the back of my mind when I was describing it.
Mm. So out on the plateau, the scouts are taking artifacts from these human-like creatures. You call them an alien species. They're known as parasapes. Can you describe the parasapes for me?
Yeah, I suppose they're like a humanoid species. And it's sort of unclear, at least for the opening parts of the book, you know, what has happened to their civilization. They kind of live amongst its ruins and they still kind of cling to these artifacts, but they kind of almost go around in, you know, almost a sort of fugue state where they seem to, they don't speak, they don't interact. They just seem to wander from place to place. And as a result, the scouts and, you know, the other people in the colony see them as, you know, a kind of almost an animal species. And, you know, that sort of, they use that to kind of justify the violence they use towards them. But ultimately throughout the book is revealed that the actual history of their species and how they've kind of come to this position, yeah.
Mm. And David is a scout. What is his job? What does he have to do as a scout?
Yes, essentially he goes up to the plateau and he takes the artifacts which the parasapes are wearing, which have some sort of effect on human memory, which is explored throughout the book, and then he essentially takes them home and sells them. But the sort of nature of the planet is that people only come to the planet every 5 years when a ship comes by. So at the start of the book, he's just reached the end of his second tour of duty. So he's been there for 10 years and he's about to go home. And that's when essentially the events of the book start.
Mm. To make it clear, he's essentially going up to these parasapes and basically just snatching jewellery off their arms. I mean, it's as simple as that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And he's part of a group which is called the Association of Chartered Geographers. And even before we know exactly what these scouts are doing, John, I don't think geography has ever sounded so nefarious before.
Yeah, I suppose there was a kind of element of sort of irony there in terms of they've sort of given themselves this quite ridiculous title, which has no bearing on what they actually do, you know, what the nature of their work is, but, you know, they still feel the need to sort of dignify it as if they're kind of carrying out some sort of grand project of exploration rather than just going up there and committing random acts of violence and, you know, filling their own pockets, essentially.
I mean, there's a broader observation here, right, about, you know, we can put seemingly benign titles on things and on practices which are far more problematic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And you've seen that throughout history, obviously. So, yeah.
And you have Aboriginal heritage, John. You're a descendant of the Kalkadoon people. Can you explain to me more broadly, you know, you've said you didn't want this to be a one-to-one allegory, but what did you want to explore about the idea of colonisation in this way?
You know, the main character, David, is, you know, he's a colonist. He's sort of like an archetypal colonist. And I suppose what I really want to examine is the kind of psychological effects of sort of acting in that role and having that relationship to your environment and ultimately how it affects your relationships towards other people. You know, as a character, David has a very sort of muted affect. He has a very kind of almost threadbare inner life. It's like he's kind of taken this approach of not thinking about his own actions, and that has resulted in reaching this position where he's very has a very limited capacity for self-reflection. And ultimately, I think really the story of the book is how he ultimately has to face the consequences of that and how he ultimately is forced to kind of account in some way for his own actions. Mm. And I think that's something that really interested me was like, what are the actual psychological effects on the people who perpetrate colonization? How does it affect their relationships with each other and what kind of societies they end up creating? Yeah.
Well, let's talk about his relationships. There's a woman in his life called Eliza. What's going on with him and Eliza?
Yeah, I suppose there's sort of almost a love triangle between Eliza and David's sort of best friend slash mentor, Tom, who's an older scout who's been on the planet for a long time. And at the opening of the book, Tom has disappeared. And Eliza has just had a child. She's got a young baby. And there's sort of this ambiguity about, you know, whether the child is in fact David's or Tom's. And that's sort of the kind of, I suppose, the sort of emotional problem that opens the book. So sort of threaded throughout it is sort of David's, again, you know, is he going to be brought to confront this reality or is he going to try and avoid it like he does, you know, other sort of difficult questions in his life? I suppose that's another kind of through line in the book as well.
Yeah, and you talked about the fact that he's kind of apathetic. You know, he's not even sure what this kid's name is, and it might be his kid.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, he takes a very sort of, as you say, apathetic's a good word for it. He takes almost a deliberately protective lack of interest in his surroundings, and he's really sort of, I suppose, forestalling his real life for when he gets back home, and he's incredibly wealthy, but even that has come to have less and less meaning for him. It's just become this sort of very abstract fantasy he kind of has recourse to, but it doesn't have much reality for him anymore. And the result is that, you know, he sort of lives in this almost sort of like, yeah, like in a kind of fugue-like state, almost like the parasites themselves.
Yeah. I was reminded reading Bird Deity of the Australian author Clegg Coleman. She uses science fiction tropes to explore ideas of colonisation and racism. Why do you think that genre fiction is such a good place to do this kind of work, John?
I mean, you really can sort of set up an imaginary situation which perhaps is similar to the, you know, real-world situations which you know, but then is also different from it in other respects. So I suppose there's almost a kind of experimental aspect to it. You can kind of pose a problem in a different way or in different terms and sort of hopefully reach something which, you know, gives some kind of insight into the world you live in, yeah.
You mentioned H.P. Lovecraft. Who else have been your big influences in sci-fi and cosmic horror?
I think in terms of the big influence on this book was a book by Edgar Allan Poe called The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, which is sort of, it's a really interesting book. It sort of begins as a kind of classic sort of 19th century sort of shipwreck narrative. But then as the plot kind of develops, it changes the genre very subtly at first and then kind of very drastically and becomes, you know, what a lot of people consider the first kind of work of sort of cosmic horror. And it ends on this totally sort of baffling but like quite frightening note. And there's just a real sense of awe throughout the book. And I really wanted to try and capture that. You know, there are parts of this book which are basically like direct homages to scenes from that novel. So it was a massive influence on me for sure. Yeah.
And what were the big challenges for you with Bird Deity?
I mean, I think the character of David posed a lot of challenges to me because in the first iteration of the novel, you know, he was a generally pretty reprehensible person.
Yeah.
Like a much more of a sort of, you know, out and out sort of just an evil person. And I suppose I realised it wasn't kind of interesting to write that kind of character. It wasn't interesting for the reader, I think, to sort of inhabit that character's consciousness because it's a close third-person narrative, so you're very much privy to his inner thoughts and emotions. I suppose I wanted to write someone who is ultimately does bad things, but his kind of flaws are more from like a mission of not thinking about what he does rather than kind of actively wishing to kind of cause harm to the people around him. Yeah, I think I ended up, I think, with a much more interesting character, but it took a lot of false starts. I think the novel, which, you know, ended up being finished was maybe the third or fourth attempt at it. So it did take quite a bit of work, yeah.
And you already have a published collection of short stories, a really acclaimed collection called Firelight. This, as we've said, is your first novel. Are we going to see more sci-fi from you, John Morrissey?
Yeah, I think I'll always come back to science fiction. I've just started a new project. It's more of a kind of gothic horror, historical fiction kind of thing.
Wow.
Yes. I mean, I like to sort of try different sort of genres and so forth to kind of, yeah, just to kind of try different angles. But I think, you know, I'll always come back to science fiction. You know, I'd like to write another sort of straight down the line science fiction novel at some point as well. So yeah, I think it'll always have a special place in my heart as a genre.
Oh, I can't wait to see what comes next. But this book is called Bird Deity. It is published by Text. John Morrissey, it's been great to meet you today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for joining me for The Book Show. Today you heard from Holden Shepherd, whose latest book is Yeah, the Boys, and John Morrissey, the author of Bird Deity. Thank you to producer Sarah Lestrange. Sarah and I make The Book Show on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.